This time on Weather Brains.
I still think this is going to be a rock and roll season.
No, we're not talking about music. We're talking about the tropics. We get an update on the 2007 Atlantic hurricane season.
Looks like we're probably going to be slightly on the cool side of neutral for this hurricane season.
And are some folks being a bit pushy about hurricane season? And speaking of hurricanes, we're going to introduce you to somebody who plans to cause a hurricane's storm surge to slam into a building made of wood.
When the wave hits, these load cells measure how much load the wave's transferring to the building.
Researcher John Vandelint has a reason for doing this, and you'll find out why. Plus, on Weather Brains 101, Professor Peters takes us into the troposphere, and he takes us back to nature. On This Week in Weather History, Bill Murray recalls the week when it rained on a famous tiger, and it's the anniversary of an earthquake that wasn't very major, but what happened afterward was horrendous. It's all coming up. Welcome to episode number 77 of Weather Brains, the netcast that is all about weather, produced by The Weather Company. I'm David Black. With me for this ride is Brian Peters, Kevin Selly, J.B. Elliott, and James Spann. Mr. Spann, what do you know? What's happening?
Well, we are right in the middle of summer, and, you know, my favorite season is fall, and I'm starting to see the back-to-school commercials on television, so I know we're getting on the downhill side of summer, and those crisp golden days of fall, October, they'll get here sooner than later, maybe.
Yeah, and those crisp nights are being enjoyed by Mr. Brian Peters, who's with us on a camping trip. And no, we're not adding sound effects in the background here. Are you really back to nature, Brian?
That's the cicadas. I'm outside at Mount Cheehaw. And contrary to what James Spann would tell you, I have permission to use the Wi-Fi, and it is a beautiful, beautiful, on the highest point in Alabama. As a matter of fact, yesterday morning and this morning, it was in the lower 60s, a little bit chilly, actually, especially Sunday morning, because we had about a 15 to 20 mile an hour wind. So I'm glad to be here, no matter where I am.
And if you're listening to us from some other parts in the country, take a visit sometime to Mount Cheehaw, highest point in Alabama. It's on the Alabama-Georgia border. It really is a pretty place up there. And if you're real lucky, you might get to see Mr. Peters up there. You never know.
The professor. Yeah. I feel like we have Grizzly Adams on here for those animal noises.
Yeah, he looked the part, too.
Yeah, he looks like Grizzly, too. Kevin Selle, you're with us from Dallas, Texas. How's life in Texas?
I am just thrilled by the sound effects. It's funny what James said, though, you know, almost done with summer, but we observed here this weekend that it really only feels like about May or something in Texas because it's been so cloudy and so rainy. We feel like we're just starting summertime around here, David.
I'll bet you guys are probably glad to have a little bit less rain to deal with, too.
Yes, that's true. And I suppose it's nice to have, you know, the 100-degree plus heat indices back where it's supposed to be here in the summertime.
I think I could do without that. It is nice, though, to have J.B. Elliott with us. So what's the status, Mr. Elliott? Are you C+, B-, A?
I'm still C+, what I was 30 minutes after I was born. And you know me, I wish all 12 months were named October and had the weather to match.
Yeah, a lot of the guys on this show really enjoy the fall months more than anything. The color's just gorgeous, and the temperatures are fabulous, and that's the ultimate time of year for a lot of people. But spring is pretty too, when you see a lot of the color bloom, so I won't be too picky. Anyway, speaking of the time of the year, thought we would spend a little bit of time and talk about the tropics right now. Not a whole lot going on in the Atlantic at this point, but a lot of people are watching with interest. We are about 1.5 months or so into the 2007 Atlantic hurricane season, and though the tropics are relatively quiet at the moment, predictions of an active season continue. We thought we'd check in with the tropical prediction crew at Colorado State University under the direction of Dr. William Gray. We caught up with Phil Klotzbach to ask how the current season is unfolding.
Well, currently the season has been unfolding about like an average season would. We've had we've already had two storms, which is about average for the June through July period. Typically, early season activity does not relate that much to what occurs during the rest of the season. The only time that it seems to have an impact is, say, if you get deep tropical activity, say storms east of the Caribbean and south of the Tropic of Cancer in June and July. That typically says that you're likely to have a very active season. We haven't seen any storms there yet. Through the middle portion of July.
So what I'm hearing from you at this point really is no big surprises.
No, nothing particularly surprising. It certainly has been It's been very quiet in the Atlantic. The Atlantic hasn't had much in the way of even deep convection from the waves yet. But again, that's fairly typical for the June-July time period. Certainly, we're keeping an eye on everything, and we'll be putting out our next forecast update on Friday, August 3rd, and we'll certainly have a lot more to say about how things are currently transitioning. And I should also mention, just in terms of El Nino, currently we're in an ENSO neutral state. It looks like we're probably going to be slightly on the cool side of neutral for this hurricane season.
And so what does that mean?
Well, basically, typically, if you have an Atlantic that's if you have a warm Atlantic and you have a neutral or a cool El Nino, or if you have neutral or La Nina conditions, you tend to have more active hurricane seasons.
Which is probably not what folks along the Atlantic and Gulf Coast want to hear you say.
Well, certainly, but I mean, again, the odds of any one particular small area getting hit in any year is very small in any year, no matter how active or inactive the individual hurricane season. But certainly, now's the time to make sure you have a plan and know what you're going to do. And if a storm does threaten and you have watches and warnings are issued, that you need to take the necessary precautions.
Very well. We'll be looking forward to your next update.
Thank you.
That's Phil Klotzbach at Colorado State University. Current predictions by Dr. Gray's team calling for 17 named storms this season, 9 of them expected to become hurricanes, and 5 of those 9 expected to become intense, meaning a Category 3, 4, or 5 storm. James, you've had a few thoughts about the hurricane season. Want to share them?
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity, David. I have heard some people, forum posts and just some people kind of whispering, where are the hurricanes? You know, is this going to be another hurricane forecast bust? If you recall last season, the Colorado State team and NOAA both were expecting a pretty active season, and it didn't happen. And I'm starting to hear people saying that, you know, it's another cry wolf thing. And I'm glad you ran that interview because we're not even at the core of the season yet. The other thing we've heard some people say, well, La Nina is a no-show so far, and you have to have a La Nina cycle to have a very active hurricane season. I totally disagree with that. If you go back and look at the most active hurricane seasons we've had in the Atlantic Basin, we were ENSO neutral. Now, no El Nino. That we all know that that's not favorable for hurricanes, but you don't have to have this La Nina cycle. If you've got a neutral ENSO condition, which is what we have right now, I've seen very active seasons, and the wave train to me, if you look at the satellite images and look at the waves coming off the coast of Africa, they seem to be more robust. We've got a wave out there in the Caribbean now, and I just get the idea we might be a couple of weeks away from a pulse up. So for the people that are saying nothing's going to happen this year, I just say, you know, if you're going to shout that stuff, wait until November before you do.
I'm wondering if this is partly because we are an instant gratification demanding society. Hurricane season starts in June, nothing happens in 3 weeks, and people say it's a bust.
I think you're right, and I also think by nature we're all to some degree whiners and moaners. You know, we just kind of live in a society where we want to gripe about something, and people are starting to gripe because the hurricane forecast is bad. But you're right, David, it is way too early to call that. And again, even I think today, somebody correct me if I'm wrong, NOAA put out a statement indicating that there is no La Nina in progress now, and some people are reading that in the, well, that means no big hurricanes this year. I'll come back maybe next week and have some better statistics, but many of the really active seasons have been during a neutral ENSO cycle, not a La Nina, not an El Nino, and we're right at neutral right now, so I still think this is going to be a rock and roll season, so strap in and hang on.
I noticed that impressive wave near the west coast of Africa today, too, on the satellite photographs.
Well, I think it's interesting, too, that the tropics, especially the Caribbean and the Gulf, have been somewhat, and to some extent the Southwest Atlantic, have been somewhat cloud-free for the last couple of weeks. It's really been amazing. I'm not one of those who jumps on the bandwagon and says, hey, you know, we're not going to have major hurricane season just yet, because as James is pointing out, late August, September, and early October really is the peak of the season. So we're a long way from the peak yet. I mean, we're still at least a month or so away. And I think things are beginning to look a little more favorable. I haven't looked at sea surface temperatures in the last few days, but I know last week they were showing some pretty good warmth. I mean, after all, with no clouds in the Caribbean, what's that sun doing but just warming that water?
In other words, just give it some time. That's what I think it's all.
And I really think, David, there is a tremendous amount of latent heat energy in that big pond out there. A vast amount of the Gulf and the Caribbean has been totally undisturbed for a long time. So just something tells me that things might start to shake and bake down there as we get into August.
Fair enough.
And we still have all of September and even well into October where we can get some biggies.
World history-making biggies. Well, imagine a major hurricane with its tremendous storm surge rushing inland, taking aim at simple wood frame homes. So what would you expect to see after that, after one of those incredibly powerful hurricane waves have finished doing their work? Well, if you're thinking what I'm thinking, you might see a few toothpick-like pieces of wood floating around, and if that much, and that would be about it. But here's an interesting question. Is there a way to build wooden structures, so that they could be better able to withstand those destructive wave forces? Well, that question apparently has never really been asked before. But researchers at Colorado State University and Oregon State University are trying to learn exactly how hurricane waves affect wood frame structures. The goal, they're hoping, is to come up with better ways to build. You could call John Vandelint Mr. Damage. He's an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at Colorado State. He's already been looking at the effects of earthquakes on multi-story wood frame structures. Now he's adding hurricanes to the mix. In fact, Professor Vandelint surveyed Mississippi homes demolished by Hurricane Katrina. I think of wood frame buildings standing up to hurricane force waves as almost a hopeless prospect. So what do you hope to accomplish with this study?
Well, I think with a study like this, it's we're not actually envisioning a two-story building withstanding a 15-foot hurricane wave breaking right into it. What we're thinking about here is really more the concept of what type of wave can it stand up against, and for instance, if the wave breaks and then is running up, or if there's some moving water or some surge, things like that. And so it's really a kind of twofold. It's to understand that point, but then also to begin to understand more about the force transfer throughout the walls themselves in the building.
So is this to say that you see a day where a wood frame structure could be built that perhaps could withstand storm surge and hurricane force winds hitting it?
I wouldn't say that it would completely withstand it. I mean, there is a possibility that the bottom level could, for instance, they build them on poles now, things like that. But it's actually more along the lines of what's a manageable level of damage for a homeowner or for a for an inhabitant, that type of thing. And so in other words, we can determine how to, based on probabilities and statistics, we can determine what an annualized loss is, much the same as, insurance underwriters do. They do something like that. And so to bring that into the design process so that somebody can spend a little bit more money up front as they build their house to save money over time.
So in other words, the house is obviously going to still take a lot of damage, but you see perhaps the structural frame perhaps staying intact.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the big thing is, you may remember in Katrina, the pictures in Waveland, Mississippi, and places like that. And really what it is it's basically just the back and forth motion of the surge, the wave action, and then things, we actually saw railroad tracks. The berm had actually been moved over and the railroad tracks were bent. And there's not much we can do against that type of power. That's the equivalent of a tornado, probably, at least. But what we're dealing with are the structures that are a little further back. And when the water rushes up, can it sustain those? Things like that.
You surveyed structures after Katrina along the Gulf Coast. What did you learn from that? What came through?
We learned actually quite a bit. We learned that there's definitely a need to improve in inspection practices. Many of the structures many of the structures are built using what we call conventional construction techniques, and that means in a nutshell, really, that's we'll build them like we've always built them. And that doesn't necessarily always work. And so some of these zones should have been built, these structures should have been designed for 135 mile an hour winds and things like that.
And they were not.
And no, they were more typically, looking in the 100 mile an hour range, if I had to guess.
Now, you are building model wood frame structures. Is it one-sixth scale replicas?
That's correct, one-sixth scale.
What are you going to do? What's going to happen to those?
Well, they'll basically they actually have every stick of lumber that a regular house would have, and they're designed to rack or to move over at the top it actually varies as the square. So when 1/36th of the force is applied, they'll move over 1/6th the amount of a real structure. And that's how we, what's called similitude. And what that is we basically, we'll put those into a wave tank, largest tsunami basin in the world at Oregon State University. And we'll increase we'll start with very small waves, just a 20th of a meter, so, 50 centimeters, and then increase the height until we get actually to about a 2-foot wave, which if you think at 1/6 scale, that's actually a 12-foot hurricane wave. And so that's, if you've ever surfed, if you think of a 12-foot wave, if that breaks on you, that's quite a bit of load.
I've never surfed in a 12-foot wave, but
most of us haven't.
But you can watch the damage progressively as you increase the wave force and height.
Exactly, and really what we're looking at is we're looking to look at the force. And so what we have is we have a steel plate under the building, and then we put load cells underneath that. And so when the wave hits, these load cells measure how much load the wave's transferring to the building, and we can also measure the displacement in different parts of the building.
So let me jump way ahead here. Is it possible that one day in the future, building codes might incorporate practices that you may learn from this study when it comes to erecting wood frame structures?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, I think the important thing to remember is this particular study is the first of its kind, and so it's likely that this study will actually spur a larger study, is what we're hoping, a larger FEMA effort or something along those lines, and because this is a problem that hasn't been addressed, and I mean that was evident when we went to Mississippi and looked at damage. I mean it was clear that many of the structures far enough back, and a lot of this can be solved with the lay of the land, building berms, things like that, to at least redirect the force, maybe not the water itself. And so there's things we can do with the structure, and then there's things we can do with I'm not an expert in this, but with public policy and things like that.
You are an expert, I think, in earthquake damage research. Do you believe wood frame structures can be built to make them more quake resistant too?
Yeah, absolutely. We do a lot of work in earthquakes. We don't favor one natural hazard, but we do a lot of shake table testing and something called performance based seismic design. And what that is that's much the same as what we're trying. We're trying to take what we've learned from earthquake engineering and apply it to wave loading and wind loading and things like this, because earthquake or seismic loading has come a long way, even for wood frame structures. And so we're looking at having the owner decide what level of damage is acceptable for a certain level of earthquake and things like that, and then we incorporate that into the design.
How long does the study last, and what happens?
For this, we're about half a year into it, and it's about another year and a half. It's a two-year study, and what we hope will happen is that we'll be able to correlate wave height with damage to typical somewhat rectangular houses, and that would be a first step, but a big step in a much larger study, which I can anticipate would be maybe a 5 or 7 year effort with a large team of researchers.
That's Colorado State University Professor John Vandelint. Now, Oregon State is helping out in this in part by providing their gymnasium-size tsunami wave tank in the damage research. Here's something I didn't know about the setup at OSU. They have this custom-built wave maker that allows them to recreate scaled hurricane waves as well as tsunami waves. Must be fascinating to see.
Gee whiz.
I'd like to see that.
I would
too. They do.
Who knows what they're going to learn? You know, I would hear somebody doing research about the viability or the survivability of a wood frame structure in hurricane storm surge and laugh. But, you know, maybe these guys will help start the ball rolling toward better building that they might at least be able to partially survive and withstand.
Well, David, in Hurricane Alicia on the Texas coast, I recall I was down there for Alicia for the National Weather Service, and we did some surveying immediately after Alicia came ashore. And I remember at the west end of Galveston Island, a house that stood out just like a sore thumb because the entire building was intact. And they used what he was describing. They used poles, and then the building was really attached to those poles that were sunk very deep into the soil, They attached the building quite well. All the windows had shutters, and the roof was not your standard roof with overhangs. It was engineered a little bit differently. And the bottom line was, as soon as they got power and water back, this guy could open his shutters and he was back in business. But his was the only house within, I don't know, 3 or 4 miles that was essentially not damaged in any way, shape, or form other than a few shingles.
Wow. I just wonder, what would it have been like if a majority of the homes hit in Katrina had been built with sturdier construction in mind? You know, he was talking about doing the survey and finding that the building was just, you know, inferior, substandard in so many cases, and so many people were wiped out as a result.
Well, David, you know what comes to mind, especially as Brian was making his comments about Galveston, is one of the bigger problems is oftentimes not necessarily the waves themselves, but as the water level comes up and things start to fall apart, then you've got this debris that is banging up against the various structures. And Brian's comments about Galveston made me remember from the 1900 hurricane, that book, Isaac's Storm. It talked about just this wall of debris that was actually several feet high as it worked its way inland on Galveston Island during that storm. It just became sort of this battering ram, almost solid, but moving with the waves under it, because the houses right along the coast just became kindling, and they started piling up and banging on the next row of houses, which brought them down, and banging on the next row of houses, which brought them down. And that pile just got bigger and bigger and more destructive as it came along. So that's a real big problem. And one other point I would mention with regard to the Oregon State, they've got a bunch of cams in their facility at the Wave Center. And so we'll put a link to their website on weatherbrains.com, David.
Excellent, yeah. And one other hurricane-related item, we mentioned Katrina there. This is something I thought was interesting. Guys, you may have heard about this. After nearly 2 years, the federal government is getting rid of thousands of pounds of ice it had sent to help victims of Katrina. The Army Corps of Engineers acknowledges that it ordered too much ice back in 2005 because local officials gave faulty estimates. I'm not making this up. FEMA decided to hang on to the ice in case it was needed for another disaster, so they paid to have it stored at 22 sites across the country. Guess who paid the bill? Anyway, but when officials couldn't be sure if it was still safe for human consumption, they decided to let it melt. Total storage cost to the taxpayers, ready for this, $12.5 million.
Oh, brother.
And one of those sites was as far away as Maine where they stored that ice.
Yeah, so literally melting down the drain. One other weather item for us, too, to look at. Austin, Texas. I wonder how many people we have listening in the Central Texas region. Not sure. Anyway, after being closed
millions.
For many? Yeah, maybe so.
Millions.
Okay.
Millions and millions.
Billions and billions. After being closed for more than 2 weeks, Lake Travis, that all folks around Austin are familiar with, was reopened on July 16th. The lake had been closed to recreation since the 29th of June, following more than 19 inches of rain that fell across the hill country of Texas, causing, you bet, severe flooding. We heard Kevin talking about all the flooding in the past couple of episodes in North Texas. Well, Central Texas has really been hit too. The lake was 15 feet above its peak elevation July 6th. Now it's only 5 feet above peak. So you really get an appreciation for the force of nature and the massive flooding and destruction that those poor folks have had to deal with.
David, you know, two guys really got to feel that force, because further downstream from Lake Travis is Town Lake, which is on the south side
of Austin. Yeah.
And there's a floodgate there. The base of that, and two guys actually got sucked through that thing in their canoe, and fortunately for them, lived to tell about it, but it was not a smooth ride for them.
Wow.
No, I bet not at all. Well, speaking of smooth ride, let's move on to the weather roundtable, and I'm going to pick right back at you, Mr. Selly, talking about a ride of a different sort. Not one you can ride up in yourself, but I'm kind of making the connection here to ballooning. Ballooning in a little different context, not going up in one, but you took part in some ballooning of sorts recently, I understand.
Well, I just wanted to give a quick plug to the National Weather Service, and maybe Brian and JB can comment on this. But over the weekend, my family, I have a 6-year-old son and my wife, and we took some of our neighbors to the National Weather Service office in Fort Worth to watch the balloon go up, the one of two daily balloons that starts the weather forecast each day. But I just wanted to give a plug for them, because they are also kind whenever you want to do that kind of a thing. But they really seem to like when people come to the local Weather Service office, because you get the nickel tour. You get to see all of their new toys, and they explain how the radar works and how the forecast works. And you get to check on all the different monitors and see what's what. And then we got to watch them prepare the little instrument package that goes on the base of the balloon and blow up that balloon and watch them launch it. And the kids that were there really enjoyed it, really had a great, great time, and learned a lot as well. But I want to thank them for allowing us to come in and do that. And if you have a Weather Service office anywhere close to you, I know that they're always thrilled to share some of their knowledge and some of their technologies. I'm sure JB and Brian did in the days when they were there.
Yeah, and I was talking about tax dollars being wasted a few minutes ago on that ICE story. This is an example, corny as it sounds, but it's true. You really can see your tax dollars at work, and it's fascinating to see what they do and how they do. Only sad part about it is I'd heard rumors that Brian was, in his days at the Weather Service, was trying to charge admission for people watching the balloon. I don't know. Brian, that's kind of low. Is that true?
No, but I did try to talk him into helium so we could sound funny with our voices.
We probably sound funny enough without it. All right.
By the way, I would like to mention that to save money, the National Weather Service uses hydrogen, which is more dangerous but can be done very safely, instead of helium, because helium is more expensive. So that's one way the National Weather Service does watch out for the tax dollars.
And let me ask you something, Brian, in all seriousness. I seem to recall that if they were able to recover the radio signed equipment, that they could, in some cases, refurbish it and spend less doing it that way. Is that right?
That's correct. Each radio sign, and now the balloon is expendable, the string is expendable, the parachute is expendable, but the radiosonde is the bulk of the cost. And I don't know the exact cost, but I believe the entire balloon, string, parachute, radiosonde is something on the order of about $350 to $400, and the bulk of that, probably around $300 to $325, is the radiosonde itself. And if they are recovered within some period of time, short period of time, they could be sent back. There's instructions on the box. They can be sent back, and they can be reconditioned. And, you know, if they haven't sat out in the weather for a long time, then they can be used over again. And roughly, now the number varies dramatically, but roughly about 30% of the instrumentation is returned and can be used over again. So that's another way.
Yeah, so they really do try to squeeze every dime they can out of the dollars that are spent. J.B. Elliott, what's on your weather brain's mind?
Want to talk about the Great Lakes. I'm fascinated by the Great Lakes. We all know how a cold wind blowing across the still relatively warm water of the Great Lakes can pick up moisture only to dump it as snow on the lee side of the lakes. Wasn't it this past winter when the snow was so deep east of the Lake Erie that it was up to the ceilings on homes?
Yeah.
The lakes also affect the weather in other places. For example, a hot west wind on a summer day in Chicago, as Brian can tell you, can shift around to the northeast and quickly cool off the east part of the city, especially along Lakeshore Drive. But I mainly want to discuss some interesting facts about the Great Lakes. They were gorged out by glaciers during the Ice Age, about the time that Brian Peters was born. The five lakes...
I'll get you back, JB.
Okay. You owe me one. The five lakes contain an estimated 5,500 cubic miles of water. They cover 94,000 square miles. They contain 6 quadrillion gallons of fresh water, which is about one-fifth of the world's supply. Only the polar ice caps in a lake in Siberia have more fresh water. And, of course, the fresh water in the polar ice caps is locked up and not available for use. Lake Superior is the largest, deepest, and coolest of the five Great Lakes. Lake Superior could contain all of the other Great Lakes plus three more Lake Eries. Lake Michigan is the second largest, and it's the only one located entirely in the U.S. borders. Lake Erie is the smallest. It's also the shallowest lake with an average depth of only 62 feet, but its near neighbor, Lake Ontario, has an average depth of 283 feet. And finally, this fact number 10, it completely blows my little fourth grade mind. If the five Great Lakes could be drained and the water spread evenly across the continental U.S., it would cover all 48 states to a depth of 9.5 feet, of course, assuming that the 48 states were flat. That's the end of my story. Maybe next week we'll take an imaginary trip to Cherry Punji, India.
That blows away my simple mind. That's a lot of water.
It sure is.
That's very interesting.
They deserve the name Great Lakes.
Sure do.
I tell you what, a follow-up for you to a Weather Brains episode we aired just recently, number 73. You may recall we talked about the Rio Grande River Valley in South Texas being vulnerable to a major hurricane because of crumbling levees that are decades old. Well, some authorities are worried the South Texas Valley might wind up being the next New Orleans. Well, on July 16th, federal authorities struck a deal with county officials in McAllen, Texas, which is in Hidalgo County. Under the deal, the county will be allowed to restore federally owned levees along the river that have eroded. In the short term, the county is going to pay for the repairs, but under the agreement, the federal government will reimburse the county later. So they are probably pretty happy to see at least some dollars starting to flow in to fix what folks there have been very, very concerned about for some time. Let's check the Weather Brains email box right quick. Thanks to Jan Curtis contacting us from Laramie, Wyoming, and also to Andy Armour from Fareham, Hampshire, England. Guys, Andy has an interesting question. Thought I'd run this by you. He writes about the butterfly effect, the phrase referring to the idea that a butterfly's wings might create tiny changes in the atmosphere that ultimately cause a tornado to appear or prevent a tornado from appearing, with the flapping wing representing a small change in the initial condition of the system and then leading to a chain of events. So here's the point, according to Andy. Stand next to any road where a truck goes by at speed and you feel the after effects of the wind that stirred up. This, of course, is happening all the time, all around the world, with trucks, cars, airplanes, trains, and such. Presumably, then, these disturbances have an effect on the atmosphere and our weather. But consider this. Before about 1800, there were no mass transit systems. You went everywhere by horse, sailboat, or on foot. Therefore, very, very little in the way of atmospheric disturbances. Surely, then, could one reason our climate has changed have something to do with all this movement? Any thoughts on that?
I think Brian should, because it's also known as cricket on Mount Cheeha effect.
It's the cicadas, not the crickets.
I saw his email, and I think that is very, very interesting, but I do not know the answer.
Nor do I. I think that the butterfly flapping its wings is a very extreme example of the theory of chaos.
Yeah.
So I'm not so sure that it should be taken literally, although it's an interesting atmosphere, so who's to say?
What about the cicada flapping its wings?
Well, they're just singing, David. They're not flapping their wings. I don't see any of them flying by me.
I think Peter's eats those things. He's out there catching them and barbecuing them and eating them. Show here.
And the mosquitoes. Yeah. Do you know why Noah could not fish off the ark?
Uh-oh.
He only had two worms.
Oh, my God.
Oh.
You know, this is really going downhill fast.
We're in a big rat hole here.
What happened? I'm not sure. We lost control somewhere. We're going to have to figure out where. Anyway.
It's the cicada effect.
I think that's what it is.
It was called episode one.
I keep looking for the volume control on the cicadas, and there's no sound effect control to change. All right, we'll try to redeem ourselves with the Weather Center. Starting off with the illustrious Professor Peters and his cicadas, and Weather Brains 101. This time, the distinguished professor teaches us about the troposphere. And on This Week in Weather History, Bill Murray recounts a bizarre and horrific natural disaster that struck near Australia during this week in 1998. And it was during this week in 2002 that heavy rains were no friend to a very famous tiger. Those and more highlights all coming up.
Weather Brains 101 with Professor Peters.
If you have your head in the clouds, you're still in the troposphere. That word comes from a Greek word, which I can't begin to pronounce, but means to turn or mix. The troposphere is the lowest layer of the atmosphere, which begins at the surface and extends to a height of about 7 kilometers or 23,000 feet at the poles, or a height of about 17 kilometers or about 60,000 feet at the equator, with some variation due to weather factors. In general, the temperature decreases with height in the troposphere, but the troposphere is also known for a great deal of vertical mixing due to solar heating of the surface. This heating warms air masses, which makes them less dense, so they rise. When an air mass rises, the pressure upon it decreases, so it expands, doing work against the opposing pressure of the surrounding air. To do work is to expend energy, so the temperature of the air mass decreases. As the temperature decreases, water vapor in the air mass may condense or solidify, releasing latent heat that further lifts the air mass. This process determines the maximum rate of decline of temperature with height, referred to as the adiabatic lapse rate. And that's definitely a topic for another episode. The tropopause is a boundary region in the atmosphere between the troposphere and the stratosphere. Here, the air ceases to cool and the air becomes almost completely dry. Above the troposphere is the stratosphere, and the temperature actually increases with height in the stratosphere. Above the stratosphere are four more layers: the mesosphere, the thermosphere, this is where the shuttle flies, the ionosphere, and the exosphere. Okay, too much spherical thinking will just get us dizzy. So that's WeatherBrains 101 for today. If you have questions about weather terms, send them to question@weatherbrains.com.
Let's take a look back at some interesting weather history for the week of July 17th through the 23rd. And it was back on July 18, 2006, that the National Weather Service office in Rapid City, South Dakota, barely missed being consumed by a grass fire. It came within 30 feet of the office, starting during the early afternoon and sweeping past the buildings that housed the Weather Service office. The staff had to secure the building in a hectic situation and evacuated the facility for 2 hours. The National Weather Service in North Platte, Nebraska, took over for the staff in Rapid City. No one was injured, and no equipment was damaged. Back on July 17, 1998, a tragedy in New Guinea as 3 tsunami caused by an earthquake just off the coast rose to a height of 45 feet, struck the north coast. Over 2,200 people died. Many of them were never found because they were swept out to sea by the waves or devoured by saltwater crocodiles. The waves destroyed 5 villages along an 18-mile stretch of coastline. And back in 1997, on July 19th, Hurricane Danny lashed the Alabama Gulf Coast with winds of 80 miles an hour. The storm stalled over the southern end of Mobile Bay, dumped 30 inches of rain on coastal Mobile and Baldwin counties. 36.71 inches of rain fell during the storm at the Dauphin Island Sea Lab, nearly 26 inches of that falling in just 7 hours. The incredible rainfall, as you can imagine, caused extensive flooding. And it was back in 2002, on July 20th, that Tiger Woods watched his dream of a golfing Grand Slam wash away in the wind and rain of the third round of the British Open in Muirfield. Known for its unpredictable weather, the course forced Tiger to suffer the worst round in his professional career up to that point, as he shot a 10-over par 81. Woods had won the first 2 majors of the year and seemed destined to win golf's Grand Slam, but the wet and windy conditions put an end to that dream. And the highest elevation F4 tornado ever observed crossed the Continental Divide back on July 21st, 1987, cutting a 24-mile path through the Teton Wilderness on the south side of Yellowstone National Park. Now, people in Phoenix, Arizona live with oppressive summer heat every year. They say the extreme heat, dust storms, and smoke from wildfires are just a small price to pay for the nearly perfect weather that the Valley of the Sun enjoys the other 9 months of the year. And when the high temperature on the afternoon of July 21st, back in 2003, reached a scalding 117 degrees, it was a record for the date, and just a few degrees short of the all-time record of 122 degrees in Phoenix. But the overnight temperature the next morning only managed to fall to 96, which is an all-time record for Phoenix. That's this week in weather history.
Thank you very much, Bill Murray. Hey, if you'd like to contact the weather geeks at WeatherBrains, I'm not sure you want to do that after this show, but that would be your option. Our email address is question@weatherbrains.com. And if you really want to go out on a limb, our toll-free telephone number is 1-888-247-8627. 1-888-247-8627. Those cicadas are just getting me. For the WeatherBrains crew and the
shower after the show.
And the official WeatherBrains cicadas, I'm David Black. Thank you for listening. We hope you'll join us again next time when who knows what creature of nature Professor Peters will bring to us. Let us hear that for a few seconds, Brian.
Au natural. The cicadas, not me.
Those bugs are just like a sleeping pill.
Amen.
Do they taste like, Brian?
Yeah, you're not making soup up there with them again, are you?
No. Never had one.
I think he puts chocolate on top. Chocolate-covered cicadas or whatever they are.
Yeah, if you're pulling down the highway, if you're pulling down the highway and you see a little stand off to the side, cicadas, be real careful. You don't want to go just buy a cup and, you know, down it. Not if Brian's around anyway. All right, guys, enjoyed it. We'll see if anybody has anything to say to us after this show. I don't know if they will.
I hope they will.
There's always a possibility.
Maybe you won't talk to me anymore.
You should
be so lucky. Just call the WeatherBrains number and just play weird sound effects into the phone.
Oh, that could be dangerous.
Moo.
Where did we go? Where did we lose control? I'm not real sure where that happened.
There's
deer up here, too. Oh. Deer and crows, squirrels, chipmunks,
snakes.
Lots of wildlife.
The professor.
No, I haven't seen any snakes.
The professor's back to nature.
Yes, all natural.
I'll see you guys.
Good night.
Good night.
Hey, here.
I'm going to record this and sell it.